Columbia Records is celebrating its 125th anniversary with the release of a book entitled 360 Sound, the Columbia Records Story, about the great American label and its role in initiating recorded music, cultivating great artists, and igniting cultural change. Written by Pulitzer Prize and Grammy-nominated author and historian Sean Wilentz, the book provides a journey through Columbia Records' storied past and its contributions to entertainment from the invention of commercial recording through the present day. Sean Wilentz is the preeminent historian whose work spans music, politics, and the arts. His writing has won numerous awards and has been nominated for a Grammy. Sean Wilentz, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Wonderful to be here, sir.
It is a beautiful volume. How did you get involved in this process?
Well, thank you, first of all. Columbia basically approached me. I'd been writing about music for a while, mostly about Bob Dylan, and I was a Columbia artist. And they wanted to have a historian, not a music writer, strictly, but a historian, to write about the label and commemorate their 125th anniversary. And I was lucky enough that they came to me, and I got involved in the thing that was much bigger than I thought it was going to be.
One of the things that you point out in the introduction is just what an impact not only this label has had on music and recorded music, but ultimately on American mass culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about this for a bit. I mean, America's always been a very musical country, right? We have songs of work, songs of play. At the end of the 19th century, the great symbols of that were the village bandstand, I suppose, that every small town seemed to have, and the piano, which every household of a certain means seemed to have. People played, people assembled, people sang. In comes recorded music, and it changes everything. It changes the whole ways in which people not only perform and understand music, but in the way that the country sounds. You know, if countries have sights, they also have sounds. And America sounded different by the 1920s than it had in the 1880s because lots of people could hear the most extraordinary artists, the great geniuses of both composition and performance, at a moment's notice anytime they wanted to, and they could hear it again and again and again. It changed people's access and people's relationship to music.
You make a point in the book, you write, Columbia has not confined itself to the latest trends, unlike those specialist labels whose passion for a particular kind of music has challenged and diversified the recording industry. Mm-hmm. Columbia has tried to cover the entire spectrum, more like an emporium than a boutique.
That's right. I mean, there are general labels and there are specific labels. The early labels tried to do everything. You know, they were just trying to record whatever they could sell. In fact, very early on, the technology was so primitive that the great stars, some of the great stars, were yodelers and whistlers, because those are the things that came across most, best on that primitive technology. But they were across the board. They had vaudeville acts, vaudeville singers, great opera singers. There was no boundary, really. They had different lists, but there was no limit to the kinds of artists that they would sign up and release.
For an artist, what was the benefit of being signed by Columbia?
Columbia could get your records into the stores. That was number one.
Yeah.
They had commercial muscle. They had commercial. That's how it began. Really, was as a franchise for selling things, on both the machines and the cylinders. But that was number one. I mean, look, it was a very, very successful company. But beyond that, the company had its own mystique. After a while, companies acquire a kind of aura about them. And because of the artists they were releasing, Al Jolson's on Columbia, and you're a young singer, and you look there and you say, well, Al Jolson, I wouldn't mind being in the same place that Al Jolson is. So that was another aspect of it. But then it was also the intelligence of the people, the insiders, not just the executives at the top, but in particular the talent scouts, if you will, the A&R men, they later became known, the artists and repertoire people. Who understand how an artist, changes, how an artist grows, who are willing to take an artist on and stick by him or her, and provide them with the kind of musical as well as intellectual as well as financial setting in which they can prosper and thrive.
One of the things that you point out is that they also have a loyalty that is very interesting to the artists. If you look at somebody like Tony Bennett or Barbara Streisand, as you mentioned, as examples of people who very early on in their career, when they were at their height, they were releasing their albums. And then now, when their new material is coming out, they're still being released on Columbia.
Columbia is very peculiar in this regard. I mean, most recording artists stay with a label for maybe 10 years, 15 years, and then jump somewhere else for a variety of reasons, artistic and financial, what have you. Columbia, however, today has any number of just superstars in the world of music, different kinds of music, who have been with the label for 30, 40, and 50 years. Tony Bennett, the longest, he signed up, believe it or not, in 1950. So, you know, he has something of an anniversary going on, too. But Barbara Streisand's been on the label since 1962. Bob Dylan's been on the label since 1962. He had a brief hiatus in the 70s, but came back to the label. So Columbia does, Billy Joel was on the label, been on the label for a long time. Leonard Cohen's been on the label. I could go on. You know, Columbia cultivates this idea that you're not simply an artist, but you're a member of the Columbia family. But not just family, but the Columbia mystique envelops you, and you add to that mystique. And that's been true for any number of very, very fine artists.
You talk early in the book about the technology and what allowed them to create this company. Mm-hmm. And then you go on, of course, and talk about much of what we've been talking about, which is the business model and what makes them different. Is there such a thing as a Columbia sound?
Columbia sound. Well, no. I mean, that's something that the artists do more to change than anything else, I think. You know, the technology eventually catches up, and Columbia's been at the forefront of changing the technology, not so much in terms of the ways that things are recorded, but the way things are heard. Columbia, for example, invented the LP, what we know as the LP, in the 1940s, late 1940s. The standard vinyl album that we know, the 33 and a third microgroove, you know, that was not there before Columbia invented it in 1948. Columbia got very involved in what we remember as hi-fi in the 1950s, giving to consumers the chance to hear music in a much richer way than before. So Columbia's been at the forefront of all of that, and to that extent, there's a Columbia sound. But they've also, you know, their idea is to capture certain kinds of artists that have very particular kinds of sounds that are distinct. For example, the Philadelphia Orchestra, those of you know, listeners who were classical music listeners as well, the Columbia Orchestra, quite apart from everything else, had a very particular kind of sound, a very lush, heavy on the strings, romantic kind of sound. And Columbia was very, very good at capturing that and marketing it.
In looking at their history, mm-hmm. were there any really bad decisions?
Oh, man. Yes. All sorts of bad decisions. I mean, you know, you can talk about Columbia as the great label that it is, but you can also mention Columbia as, you know, the label that did not sign Elvis Presley, for example.
Right.
You know, the label did not sign Buddy Holly, for example. Very slow to get onto rock and roll. Once it got involved in rock and roll, you know, it went whole hog. But no. I mean, Columbia has not always been at the forefront artistically. That said, once it does figure things out, it does go big time, so that by the early 1970s, Columbia was the biggest rock and roll album, label, in the world. But along the way, you know, there are all sorts of, you know, it's in the book, all sorts of, opportunities that were lost. But I've been more impressed, actually, with how the label has made opportunities and then how it's, the number of times that it's overlooked them.
And how have they made the transition into, I believe, what you refer to as a dizzying digital world?
Yeah. Well, like all of the record companies, it's been challenging. What it even is a label anymore, right? I mean, I don't think my kids who are in their, you know, 20s and 30s, you know, they don't recognize what a label is because everything is digitized. You know, they don't really know one label from another. What Columbia's had to do is to reassert and restructure its own sense of what the business is about. So it's done, and it's done so in a number of different ways, getting involved in television in new ways. You know, the Glee phenomenon, for example, it's a lot, you know, Columbia's right in the middle of all of that. But, you know, it's also tried to find ways, again, to keep the best artists, new artists, emerging artists, in their stable. If labels have any function, it's as gatekeepers, and that's a dirty word in some sectors. But with the proliferation of music in the digital world, right, there's this kind of cacophony out there on the Internet and elsewhere, and you can't really discriminate. There's no one to tell you, well, you should be checking out this artist or that artist. Record labels serve as the arbiter. They're the people who can tell you, look, these are the people worth listening to. These are our artists. Listen. And more often than not, they get it right, so that you have an artist like Adele, who's making it big over in England. Columbia hears that, picks up on her, and signs a deal with her company, and now Adele is the biggest thing, you know, since sliced bread in the music world.
You do have a chapter in the book called Turbulence and Opportunity in the Digital Age, so we talk about the turbulence. So for the future, their opportunity is what?
The opportunity is to try and do kinds of mixes to keep up with the trends in entertainment culture, right? And to do crossover mixes which weren't available before at all, like on television, like between concerts and performances, all kinds of things that you couldn't do before, but it can be done now because of the digital technology.
And you look at this as a label and a celebration of 125 years, and for someone to dip into a story like this, which I assume this turned out to be a much larger project than you had intended.
Man. In all sorts of ways. I mean, I had to learn all that science. I had to learn all of that business stuff. I had to learn about the graphic arts. But then, I mean, basically a book that began as a 30,000-word project, which is moderate, ended up being a 90,000-word project, which is not so moderate.
But it brings to mind of whether you're talking about country artists or classical artists or rap artists or pop artists, I found myself interested and reading it, which I guess shows how eclectic we are in our musical tastes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And this goes back to the department store phenomenon. I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday, in fact, about how much more niched music has become, right? I mean, there's jazz, there's pop, there's rock, and they never quite meet up. But individual listeners get involved in all of those different things. So that, you know, I know myself, I will switch from a country station to a blues station to a rock and roll station, even to a top 40 station occasionally. And, you know, I listen to all of those different kinds of music. And that's something that, again, it's something that a savvy record label is on top of.
So following this segment on our program, we will have something called The Tune for Today. Every day we pick a tune that we play. Realizing that I'm putting you on the spot, if you had to pick one song for us to play to honor Columbia on the 125th, coming out of this segment, what would it be?
Oh, man. The last thing that Dave has on to say, if it's arousing, 11:30 in the morning, waking people up still, I would do some Ellington.
Okay, Duke Ellington. You got it.
Very good.
The book is 360 Sound, the Columbia Records story. It is published by Chronicle. Sean Wilentz, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing this project with us.
Joe, it was a delight.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, 360 Sound by Sean Wilentz. It's published by Chronicle. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.